I want twice daily meetings, Bannon said. In here 7 every morning and maybe 10 at night.
If we're in town, Froelich said.
She headed for the door. Reacher and Nagley followed her out of the room. Reacher caught her and nudged her elbow and steered her left instead of right, down the corridor toward her office.
Do the database search, he whispered.
She glanced at her watch.
It's way too slow.
So start it now and let it compile all day.
Won't Bannon do it?
Probably. But double-checking never hurt anybody. She paused. Then she turned and headed for the interior of the floor, lit up her office and turned on her computer. The NCIC database had a complex search protocol. She entered her password and clicked the cursor into the box and typed thumbprint.
Be more specific, Reacher said. That's going to give you 10 zillion plain vanilla fingerprint cases.
She tabbed backward and typed thumbprint plus document plus letter plus signature.
Okay,
she said. He shrugged. I was born before these things were invented.
It's a start, Nagley said. We can refine it later if we need to.
So Froelich clicked on search, and the hard disk chattered and the inquiry box disappeared from the screen.
Let's go,
she said. Moving a threatened vice president-elect from the District of Columbia to the great state of North Dakota was a complicated undertaking. It required 8 separate Secret Service vehicles, 4 police cars, a total of 20 agents, and an airplane. Staging the local political rally itself required 12 agents, 40 local police officers, 4 state police vehicles, and 2 local canine units. Froelich spent a total of 4 hours on the radio in order to coordinate the whole operation. She left her own Suburban in the garage and used a stretched town car with a driver so she could be free to concentrate on giving orders. Reacher and Nagley sat with her in the back, and they drove out to Georgetown and parked near Armstrong's house. 30 minutes later, they were joined by the gun car and 2 Suburbans. 15 minutes after that, an armored Cadillac Stretch showed up and parked with its passenger door tight against the tent. Then 2 Metro Cruisers sealed the street, top and bottom. Their light bars were flashing. All vehicles were using full headlights. The sky was dark gray and a light rain was falling. Everybody kept their engines idling to power their heaters, and exhaust fumes were drifting and pooling near the curbs. They waited. Froelich talked to the personal detail in the house and the Air Force ground crew at Andrews. She talked to the cops in their cars. She listened to traffic reports from a radio news helicopter. The city was jammed because of the weather. The Metro Traffic Division was recommending a long loop right around the Beltway. Andrews reported that the mechanics had signed off on the plane and the pilots were aboard. The personal detail reported that Armstrong had finished his morning coffee.
Move him, she said.
The transfer inside the tent was invisible, but she heard it happen in her earpiece. The limo moved away from the curb, and a Suburban jumped ahead of it and formed up behind the lead cop. The gun car came next, then Froelich's Stretch, then the second Suburban, then the trail cop. The convoy moved out and straight up Wisconsin Avenue, through Bethesda, traveling directly away from Andrews. But then it turned right and swung onto the Beltway and settled in for a fast, clockwise loop. By then Froelich was patched through to Bismarck and was checking the arrival arrangements. Local ETA was 1 o'clock, and she wanted plans in place so she could sleep on the flight. The convoy used the north gate into Andrews and swept right onto the tarmac. Armstrong's limo stopped with its passenger door 20 feet from the bottom of the steps up to the plane. The plane was a Gulfstream twin jet painted in the Air Force's ceremonial blue United States of America livery. Its engines were whining loudly and blowing rain across the ground in thin waves. The Suburbans spilled agents, and Armstrong slid out of his limo and ran the 20 feet through the drizzle. His personal detail followed, and then Froelich and Nagley and Reacher. A waiting press van contributed 2 reporters. A second 3-man team of agents brought up the rear. Ground crew wheeled the stairs away, and a steward closed the airplane door. Inside, it was nothing like the Air Force One Reacher had seen in the movies. It was more like the kind of bus a small-time rock band would ride in, a plain little vehicle customized with 12 better-than-stock seats. 8 of them were arranged in 2 groups of 4, with tables between each facing Pear, and there were four facing ahead in a row straight across the front. The seats were leather, and the tables were wood, but they looked out of place in the utilitarian fuselage. There was clearly a pecking order about who sat where. People crowded the aisle until Armstrong chose his place. He went for a backward-facing window seat in the port side foursome. The two reporters sat down opposite. Maybe they had arranged an interview to kill the downtime. Froelich and the personal detail took the other foursome. The backup agents and Nagley took the front row. Reacher was left with no choice. The one seat that remained put him directly across the aisle from Froelich, but it also put him right next to Armstrong. He stuffed his coat into the overhead bin and slid into the seat. Armstrong glanced at him like he was already an old friend. The reporters checked him out. He could feel their inquiring gaze. They were looking at his suit. He could see them thinking, too upmarket for an agent. So who is this guy? An aide? An appointee? He buckled his seatbelt like sitting next to vice presidents-elect was something he did every 4 years, regular as clockwork. Armstrong did nothing to disabuse his audience, just sat there, poised, waiting for the first question. The engine noise built, and the plane moved out to the runway. By the time it took off and leveled out, almost everybody except those at Reacher's table was fast asleep. They all just shut down like professionals do when they're faced with a window between periods of intense activity. Froelich was accustomed to sleeping on planes, that was clear. Her head was tucked down on her shoulder, and her arms were folded neatly in her lap. She looked good. The three agents around her sprawled a little less decorously. They were big guys, wide necks, broad shoulders, thick wrists. One of them had his foot shoved out in the aisle. It looked to be about size 14. He assumed Nagley was asleep behind him. She could sleep anywhere. He had once seen her sleep in a tree on a long stakeout. He found the button and laid his chair back a fraction and got comfortable. But then the reporters started talking. To Armstrong, but about him.
"Can we get a name, sir, for the record?"
one of them said. Armstrong shook his head. "I'm afraid identities need to remain confidential at this point."
"But we can assume we're still in the national security arena here?"
Armstrong smiled, almost winked. "I can't stop you assuming things." The reporters wrote something down, started a conversation about foreign relations, with heavy emphasis on military resources and spending. Reacher ignored it all and tried to drift off. Came around again when he heard a repeated question and felt eyes on him. One of the reporters was looking in his direction.
"But you do still support the doctrine of overwhelming force?"
the other guy was asking Armstrong. Armstrong glanced at Reacher.
"Would you wish to comment on that?"
Reacher yawned.
"Yes. I still support overwhelming force, that's for sure. I support it big time. Always have, believe me."
The reporters both wrote it down. Armstrong nodded wisely. Reacher laid his chair back a little more and went to sleep. He woke up on the descent into Bismarck. Everybody around him was already awake. Froelich was talking quietly to her agents, giving them their standard operational instructions. Nagley was listening along with the three guys in her row. He glanced out Armstrong's window and saw a brilliant blue sky and no clouds. The earth was tan and dormant 10,000 feet below. He could see the Missouri River winding north to south through an endless sequence of bright blue lakes. He could see the narrow ribbon of I-94 running east to west, the brown, urban smudge of Bismarck, where they met.
"We're leaving the perimeter to the local cops,"
Froelich was saying.
"We've got 40 of them on duty, maybe more, plus state troopers in cars. Our job is to stick close together. We'll be in and out quick. We're arriving after the event has started, and we're leaving before it finishes."
"Leave them wanting more,"
Armstrong said to nobody in particular.
"Works in show business,"
one of the reporters said. The plane yawed and tilted and settled into a long, shallow glide path. Seatbacks came upright and belts were ratcheted tight. The reporters stowed their notebooks. They were staying on the plane. No attraction in open-air local politics for important foreign relations journalists. Froelich glanced across at Reacher and smiled, but there was worry in her eyes. The plane put down gently and taxied over to a corner of the tarmac where a five-car motorcade waited. There was a state police cruiser at each end, and three identical stretched town cars sandwiched between. A small knot of ground crew standing by with a rolling staircase. Armstrong traveled with his detail in the center limo. The backup crew took the one behind it. Froelich and Reacher and Nagley took the one in front. The air was freezing, but the sky was bright. The sun was blinding.
"You'll be freelancing," Froelich said, "wherever you feel you need to be."
There was no traffic. It felt like empty country. There was a short, fast trip over smooth concrete roads, and suddenly Reacher saw the familiar church tower in the distance and the low surrounding huddle of houses. There were cars parked solid along the side of the approach road all the way up to a state police roadblock 100 yards from the community center entrance. The motorcade eased past it and headed for the parking lot. The fences were decorated with bunting, and there was a large crowd already assembled, maybe 300 people. The church tower loomed over all of them, tall and square and solid and blinding white in the winter sun.
"I hope this time they checked every inch of it," Froelich said.
The five cars swept onto the gravel and crunched to a stop. The backup agents were out first. They fanned out in front of Armstrong's car, checking the faces in the crowd, waiting until Froelich heard the all clear from the local police commander on her radio. She got it and instantly relayed it to the backup leader. He acknowledged immediately and stepped to Armstrong's door and opened it ceremoniously. Reacher was impressed. It was like a ballet. 5 seconds, serene, dignified, unhurried, no apparent hesitation at all. But there had already been three-way radio communication and visual confirmation of security. This was a slick operation. Armstrong stepped out of his car into the cold. He was already smiling, a perfect local boy embarrassed by all the fuss smile, and stretching out his hand to greet his successor at the head of the reception line. He was bareheaded. His personal detail moved in so close they were almost jostling him. The backup agents got close, too, maneuvering themselves so they kept the tallest two of the three between Armstrong and the church. Their faces were completely expressionless. Their coats were open, and their eyes were always moving.
"That damn church," Froelich said. "It's like a shooting gallery."
"We should go check it again," Reacher said. "Ourselves, just to be sure. Have him circulate counterclockwise until we do."
"That takes him nearer the church."
"He's safer nearer the church. Makes the downward angle too steep. There are wooden louvers up there around the bells. The field of fire starts about 40 feet out from the base of the tower. Closer than that, he's in a blind spot." Froelich raised her wrist and spoke to her lead agent. Seconds later, they saw him ease Armstrong to his right into a wide counterclockwise loop around the field. The new senator tagged along. The crowd changed direction and moved with them. "Now find the guy with the church keys," Reacher said. Froelich spoke to the local police captain, listened to his response in her ear.
"The church warden will meet us there," she said. 5 minutes.
They got out of the car and walked across the gravel to the church gate. The air was very cold. Armstrong's head was visible among a sea of people. The sun was catching his hair. He was well out in the field, 30 feet from the tower. The new senator was at his side, 6 agents close by. The crowd was moving with them, slowly changing its shape like an evolving creature. There were dark overcoats everywhere. Women's hats, mufflers, sunglasses. The grass was brown and dead from night frosts. Froelich stiffened, cupped her hand over her ear, raised the other hand and spoke into her wrist microphone.
"Keep him close to the church," she said.
Then she dropped her hands and opened her coat, loosened her gun in its holster.
"State cops on the far perimeter just called in. They're worried about some guy on foot."
"Where?" Reacher asked.
"In the subdivision."
"Description?"
"Didn't get one."
"How many cops on the field?"
40 plus, all around the edge."
"Get them facing outward, backs to the crowd, all eyes on the near perimeter." Froelich spoke to the police captain on the radio and issued the order. Her own eyes were everywhere.
"I gotta go," she said.
Reacher turned to Nagley. "Check the streets," he said. "All the access points we found before." Nagley nodded and moved out toward the entrance drive, long, fast strides halfway between walking and running.
You found access points?
Frolic asked, like a sieve. Frolic raised her wrist.
Move now, bring him tight against the tower wall, cover on all three sides, stand by with the cars, now, people.
She listened to the response, nodded. Armstrong was coming close to the tower on the other side, maybe 100 feet away from them, out of their line of sight.
You go, Reacher said, I'll check the church.
She raised her wrist.
Now keep him there, she said, I'm coming by.